Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The hurly-burly of a capitalist economy can make it hard to pinpoint the moment when a company's fate is decided. Unfortunately for General Motors, we can time theirs down to the minute. At 12:01 this morning, GM's latest offer to its bondholders expired, a debt-for-stock swap. The lenders passed, and so the bankruptcy clock is ticking even louder today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society, ffyf.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday, everybody. It is May the 27th today. And as it happens, 27 is also the number in billions of dollars that General Motors owes its bondholders. They're the big banks and other institutional investors that GM has borrowed from over the years. Part of the carmaker's plan to stay out of Chapter 11 hinges on its ability to convince those lenders to take less than they're entitled to, probably pennies on the dollar. Not enough of those bondholders agreed to a stock swap by GM's cutoff of midnight last night. So it's now widely expected that the company is not going to be able to meet the White House deadline of Monday for a viable way to avoid bankruptcy. This is, if you remember, exactly the same point that the Chrysler bankruptcy turned on, creditors saying no deal. We asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to explain why bondholders get so much say anyway.
The reason is pretty simple.
Bondholders have power because bondholders controlled, in GM's case, $27 billion worth of debt.
That's one of GM's bondholders, Ted Dobsky. He's not with a big hedge fund or institution. He worked at GM for 33 years and now drives for a transportation company in Detroit. He bought the bonds through his retirement plan. In exchange for the federal government's help, both GM and Chrysler had to convert two-thirds of their debt to equity, that is, stock. So they needed people like Dobsky to sign on. He didn't.
When you look at what they were giving us, it's just an absolute no-brainer.
GM offered bondholders stock worth just a fraction of their original investment. Dobsky says it would take him about 10 years working to make that back. GM has plenty of big bondholders, too. And there's another reason they've wielded so much power in this process. Bankruptcy lawyer Doug Bernstein says many of them have a form of insurance on their bonds. It kicks in the event of bankruptcy.
So there's no incentive for them to take a compromise. And if they go into bankruptcy, they can make the claim and get paid 100-cent dollars.
For bondholders without that insurance, it's not clear if they'll get a better deal in court. All of these bonds are unsecured, meaning there's no collateral backing them up. Unsecured lenders often get pennies on the dollar in bankruptcy. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
At a press conference a month or two ago, President Obama was asked about the government's role in Detroit's troubles, what kind of shareholder Washington will turn out to be. The kind that's looking to sell was the president's answer. And thanks to the New York Times today, we now know taxpayers will have far more of GM to sell off than we'd thought, 70% of the company, to be precise. Micheline Maynard covers Detroit for the New York Times. Mickey, good to talk to you again.
Thank you always, Kai.
I think we were ready, most people, for maybe 50%, slight majority ownership of General Motors. 70% that you reported in the paper today, that seems quite a bit more. How did we get there?
It is quite a bit of a surprise. And the last time we knew, General Motors put in a regulatory filing saying that the government would get about half the company, the UAW would get 39%, and the rest would go to shareholders and bondholders. Well, the government is going to put in a lot of money. It sounds like they're going to put about $50 billion into GM and maybe more than that. And apparently the Treasury decided that they wanted to have a bigger stake given the size of the investment.
Just to be clear, this does not mean that Timothy Geithner and the president are going to be sitting on the GM board figuring out what models to sell, right?
Well, the Treasury is trying to make it very clear that there won't be government employees running the company, but you could make an argument that the president will have some input into what's in these companies' lineups going forward. And I say that because of the fuel economy regulations that were just proposed. We know the president is interested in hybrid cars. He owns a Ford hybrid, and he's taken a real interest in the industry, something that the industry hasn't seen in recent memory.
You can see this turning into a real conflict of interest situation, right? I mean, already you've got congressmen calling the White House Automotive Task Force, asking to know why certain dealerships got closed. You can see them perhaps being accused of favoring GM or Chrysler over Ford, who's not getting any of these bailouts. Where does this 70% leave that development?
Well, we're in uncharted territory here. People have been drawing a parallel with Amtrak back in, I think it was the late 1970s, when that was created, basically the government getting into the passenger railroad business. I think they'd like to keep their hands off, but you're right, there's a ton of conflicts that go on. It would have been the same if there had been a congressional bailout, too. People would be lobbying their members of Congress. As for Ford, I think they might actually get a little bit of an advantage in the mind of the public because they are the company that hasn't filed for bankruptcy. Not that GM has yet, but that's coming. They haven't taken any federal money. They've got cash. They are introducing new products, and seems like the president has gone out of the way to be nice to Alan Mulally, the CEO of Ford Motor Company. So, you know, if they can just keep their heads above water and just keep moving forward, they might just leave the trail of all this behind them.
Is there any doubt in your mind that GM will file for bankruptcy sometime between now and Monday?
No, I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion. The only thing that could happen is there could be a delay because this is a very complicated case, and it's something that the bankruptcy world has never seen before.
All right, well, given that then, is Monday just going to be anticlimactic?
Not at all, because, you know, it's one thing to talk about something as an inevitability and another for it to actually happen. I think the day that I write the lead of the story that says General Motors filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, I mean, you stare at the computer screen and go, gee, this is really happening.
Micheline Maynard covers Detroit for the New York Times. Mickey, thanks a bunch.
My pleasure, Kai.
From the Marketplace desk of The More Things Change, The More They Stay the Same, there were reports today that two more big banks are set to boost the pay for some employees. The Wall Street Journal says Citigroup and Bank of America will soon raise base salaries for their prized investment bankers. Morgan Stanley did something similar last week. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more now on what this might mean for the Obama administration's plan to overhaul Wall Street compensation.
The big banks keep insisting they're only taking the steps necessary to retain key employees, even in the face of the verbal lashing they took from President Obama just a few months ago.
What gets people upset, and rightfully so, are executives being rewarded for failure.
The Obama administration plans to impose rules in the near future aimed at realigning pay with performance at firms getting federal bailout money, but the banks are apparently trying to stay a step ahead. John Coffey heads Columbia University's Center on Corporate Governance. He says raising base salaries isn't necessarily a bad thing if it does indeed replace the bonuses that led to risky investments for only short-term gains.
That's what triggered their bonus compensation. They lived under an eat-what-you-kill incentive compensation formula. You were concerned only with getting that huge bonus in year one, and what happened to the company thereafter was someone else's problem.
Coffey cautions, though, that there could be an ulterior motive. The banks may expect the Treasury Department's new rules to limit bonuses to a certain percentage of the base compensation, so raising the base salary could also be a way to justify bigger bonuses, too. But then, what are the chances the banks would try to do that?
Bank employees are very motivated to find ways to game the system and probably have their hearts in it a little bit more than the Treasury Department, which may be worried primarily about the political fallout of seeming to authorize high bonuses.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has promised to unveil his new pay rules by mid-June, and he said over the weekend that very, very substantial change is needed in banking compensation practices. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Long about midday today, traders decided they didn't really like what they were hearing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown promised to punish lawmakers in his party who've been playing fast and loose with their expense reports. Brown said offending members of parliament would be banned from seeking re-election, and that'll likely be the least of the changes this story brings. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London that the financial scandal has triggered promises of radical constitutional reform.
The Daily Telegraph newspaper started it all, publishing day by day MPs' most closely guarded secrets, how much they're getting in parliamentary expenses and what for. One claimed $600 for horse manure, another $2,500 for a duck house. Some claimed tens of thousands for non-existent mortgages. Voters are furious. Inside Parliament, scores of MPs have been cowering in disgrace, says Labour member Stephen Pound.
It's like a slasher movie where every morning we come in and see who's still alive. It really is very, very desperate and very, very dark. But what makes it worse is that it's nobody else's fault except our own.
All the main parties have been damaged. In a bid to rebuild public trust, they've been vying with each other to offer the most radical change. Here's the Prime Minister suggesting that an outside body should control MPs' pay and expenses.
Westminster cannot operate like some gentleman's club, where the members make up the rules and operate them among themselves.
And here's the Conservative leader of the opposition going even further.
We will begin a massive redistribution of power in our country from the political elite to the man and the woman in the street.
He wants to cut the size of Parliament, reduce the power of a Prime Minister, have more referendums. But some commentators say these grand plans miss the point. The people just want politicians that don't fiddle their expenses. At the next election, all those MPs tainted by this affair could lose their seats, roughly half the House of Commons. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
With the president's announcement yesterday that federal appeals court judge Sonia Sotomayor is in line for a promotion, the money machine is kicking into gear. Over the past couple of decades, Supreme Court nominations have featured big media buys and nonstop cable chatter, too. Marketplace's Steve Henn has one reason for that. Some big institutions have a vested interest in cheering on the fight.
The first TV ads in support of Judge Sonia Sotomayor's nomination to the Supreme Court hit the air today, less than 24 hours after word of her nomination leaked out.
I will seek somebody with a sharp and independent mind.
The ad's text someone highlights Sotomayor's accomplishments, like serving as a prosecutor and graduating from Princeton and Yale. It was paid for by the liberal group Coalition for Constitutional Values. In the past two decades, roughly a dozen different nonprofits across the political spectrum have set up in Washington with the goal of pushing their judicial agenda. Call it the Supreme Court Nomination Industrial Complex. These groups exist to influence nomination fights, but they also depend on these fights to raise money and survive.
Opportunities like this seldom come along.
Conservative activist Richard Viguerie runs a direct mail firm. He's using it to fan the flames of opposition and raise cash. And when it comes to encouraging controversy over court nominations, political partisans have plenty of company. John Morton is a columnist at the American Journalism Review.
You know, the media like conflict, wherever it comes from, regardless of how phony it might be.
Commercials about the last couple Supreme Court nominations have cost about $1 million each. But insiders say those ads brought in even more cash. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Obviously, it's early days in the Sotomayor confirmation fight. There's political money still to be spent, as Steve was just talking about, background checks and Senate hearings yet to come. A lot of ground is going to be covered over the next couple of months. For commentator David Frum, not enough of the right kind of ground.
Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor will certainly face questioning about Roe v. Wade and same-sex marriage and other hot-button issues at her confirmation hearings. She'll very likely be grilled about executive power and terrorism. Senators will consider her judicial temperament, including reported complaints from former Second Circuit clerks that she behaved as, quote, kind of a bully on the bench. Odds are, however, that she will face almost no questions about commercial law, taxation, and bankruptcy. This omission would be especially glaring now. The Obama administration is challenging settled principles of commercial law in ways more radical than anything seen since the 1930s. In the Chrysler bankruptcy, it told secured creditors that they were unpatriotic profiteers for asserting their undoubted legal rights. That case now threatens to become a precedent for the looming General Motors bankruptcy, and who knows how many other cases. Yet the current court justices have strikingly little experience as business lawyers. Chief Justice John Roberts has worked for business clients, but always as an appellate litigator, that is, as a kind of after-the-fact freelance pleader, not a counselor who navigates a company's way through the tangles of existing law. Only one justice, John Paul Stevens, has done much advising of business clients half a century ago, and Stevens is the most senior member of the court, aged almost 90. President Obama has talked of his desire for empathy in his nominees. Yet, ironically, with this judicial pick, he has confirmed a trend toward judges whose experience of business law is abstract and academic, who do not know what it means to explain to a client that what was a secured debt yesterday is not a secure debt today. A little empathy for the people who make America's economy go? How about that for a change?
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Take a moment to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, how we became a bailout nation.
You know, this is the untold story of the credit crisis and collapse. Most of Wall Street is furious at what happened.
But first, let's do the numbers. We'll start as we always do with stocks, but the prologue to the market today was a rise in long-term borrowing costs. That helps explain why the Dow gave back nearly all of yesterday's gains. It dropped 173 points, 2%. Finished at an even 8,300. The NASDAQ retreated 19 points, 1.1%, closed at 1731. The S&P 500 sank 17 points, 1.9% there, wrapped up at 893. A pop in long-term interest rates triggered worries that the government might have trouble keeping borrowing costs low. It also caused investors to move some of their money out of stocks into bonds. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note climbed to 3.73% today. Prices fell. The yield rose nearly a quarter of 1% just today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and its 57th Annual Management Conference with faculty debating the future of markets. May 29th, chicagobooth.edu. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for April. The National Academies holds a workshop on the science of adolescence, looking at what influences teens to take risks. And Amnesty International launches its annual report on the state of the world's human rights. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Reports from the world of retail haven't been all that great since the recession took hold. Sales are tanking, stores are closing, even entire chains like Circuit City and Mervyn's have gone under. One might imagine, then, that this would be a less than ideal time to open a new business. But creative marketing can really work wonders. Pop-up stores are the latest example. One here, one there, and then they're gone after just a couple of months. Target is probably the best-known retailer that's used them. But now luxury goods makers want some of the action. Sally Herships reports on retail's new disappearing act.
I'm standing in front of New York City's Port Authority bus terminal with marketing consultant Rob Spira. There's loads of traffic, construction noise, fast food joints, and a liquor store nearby.
The Port Authority is not a particularly beautiful space.
It may not be stylish, but it's the site of Spira's new store called Save Fashion. Stocked with cashmere sweaters and $400 dresses, it opened a few weeks ago, and it'll be gone by next month. It's a pop-up.
Shira Carmi is Spira's partner. She says pop-ups have a particular draw for shoppers.
This is a special event. It's one time only. You have to go out of your way to get here. It's very special. It's temporary.
You may have seen pop-ups before at Halloween and Christmas for costumes and decorations, or as showcases for guest designers at discounters like Target. But now the creme de la creme of retail is getting into the game. Miles Socha is the European editor of Women's Wear Daily.
Chanel has done a pop-up store at Dover Street Market in London. Yves Saint Laurent recently did one in an art gallery in the Lower East Side.
And last week, Hermès opened a temporary boutique in New York's Tony East Hampton. Socha says pop-up stores help landlords and retailers. Owners can get tenants into empty spaces, even if it's only for a few months. Retailers get short leases and a chance to try out a new neighborhood without a big investment.
So it's also a way for these brands to sort of put themselves in a different kind of environment and imbue themselves with a bit of downtown cool and edginess and tap into sort of a new slice of customers.
The novelty of pop-ups lets high-end retailers do things they wouldn't do in typical stores, like offer big discounts. Again, Shira Carmi.
It's not like you walk into a store where you used to buy $1,000 handbags and now all of a sudden it's $500. And that allows the designers to sell it at a discount without tarnishing their brand.
Pop-up stores are typically more bare bones than permanent locations, so they can be flexible in a tough economy. Rob Spira says Save Fashion recently decided to extend its stay at Port Authority an extra 2 weeks.
We've had press here. We have had fashionistas. We have had fancy designers, not fancy designers. And, like, they're all hanging out in the Port Authority and having a great experience.
Women's Wear Daily editor Miles Socha says, as long as the economy stays sluggish, we're likely to see more pop-ups from all sorts of brands. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Years from now, when you hear the word bailout, you're probably going to think of this particular moment in economic time and all the money that the government has given to banks and automakers and insurance companies. Even the porn industry asked for a handout, although they didn't get it. Barry Ritholtz writes about the current state of affairs in his new book, Bailout Nation. He works on Wall Street. He's the CEO and director for equity research for a company called Fusion IQ. So I asked him where we are right now in the bailout story.
We've kind of gone through this cycle of we don't really understand it, but it sounds like a lot of money, to, gee, I guess it's an emergency, they have to do it, to this was absolutely a generational theft. Why do we give all this money to people who caused the problem in the first place? This is ridiculous.
Let me back you up for a minute and first point out that you're a guy who makes his living doing research on Wall Street for Wall Street firms, right?
That is correct, yes.
So how do you feel about trying to figure out whose fault this is? I mean, is it Wall Street's fault? Is it Washington's fault? I mean, Wall Street was doing what it was supposed to do, right? Make money?
From the Wall Street perspective, people were getting paid for taking exorbitant risks and piling up a whole bunch of money, but they weren't getting paid based on if that was profitable or not. The best example is AIG Financial Products, where essentially they were getting 0.1% on these derivatives that they had written. And, you know, you write $3 trillion worth of derivatives, and even 0.1% is a lot of money. It's $3 billion a year. But in order to get that $3 billion, they had to expose the firm to just incredible amounts of risk. And guess what? The risk came up double zero, and the firm went bust.
Well, how does Wall Street feel about what Wall Street did?
Most of Wall Street is furious at what happened. Most of Wall Street aren't involved in mortgage securitization or derivatives or any of the other bad assets that have been blowing up. The average guy, you know, Wall Street is a meritocracy. Eat what you kill. You, as much as you can earn in profits, you get to take as a bonus. And I know a lot of guys at everywhere from Merrill Lynch to Bear Stearns to Lehman that actually were really profitable. But because this one division was run, you know, by rogue pirate traders and reckless derivative salesmen, they wiped out the entire bonus pool for the entire firm and then some, all the while engaging in really reckless behavior.
Do you figure we're stuck now as a bailout nation? We're going to be subsidizing banks and car companies and insurance companies for some time to come?
You know, we've already seen the trucking industry make hints they want stuff, and we've seen the home builders who are key players in this who just overbuilt everything. You know, they've been asking for a bailout. That's the slippery slope. Once you reward people for their worst behavior, for, you know, speculative, irresponsible investing, and punish the prudent and the people who were careful with that money, everybody seems to think it's a free-for-all. Hey, you got yours. How do I get mine?
What's the alternative to these bailouts? I mean, should we have just done nothing?
What you do is what the FDIC does when a bank is found to be insolvent. Look what happened with Washington Mutual. On a Friday afternoon, the FDIC shows up and said, according to our reading of your books, you are insolvent. They fire the board of directors. They fire the senior management. They take the assets and figure out what it's worth. And they've already reached out to potential buyers. J.P. Morgan wrote a big multi-billion-dollar check. It is a controlled dissolution or reorganization where the net result isn't that Uncle Sam is running the banks, which is what's happening with Bank of America and Citigroup and AIG. What you're actually doing is following the law. The FDIC rules require insolvent banks to be put out of their misery and put into good hands. You don't want to reward incompetent management. And that's pretty much what we've been doing. Oh, you guys drove this company into the ground and you've lost $180 billion? Here's a check. Come back if you need some more. It's insane.
Barry Ritholtz runs a blog called The Big Picture. More to the point, though, his book is called Bailout Nation. Barry, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, proof that the recession hits everybody. The Pope's radio station is going to start running ads for the first time in the 78 years it's been on the air. Vatican Radio said this week it's going to start taking what the Pope's spokesman calls ideologically sound commercials come July. The first spot is going to be from the Italian energy company Enel. They don't call them ads, by the way. It's publicity. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 173 points, 2%. The NASDAQ lost 19 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 slipped down 17 points, 1.9%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, getting the scoop from a British banker, or at least trying.
You'll probably find a lot of people willing to tell you how they make decisions, the process, but if you're using all this to try and make money, why would you tell everybody else exactly what decisions you're making, you know?
It's another installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for it tomorrow.
American Public Media.